Today, a new survey on the state of America's mental health was released. It says nearly half of all Americans will suffer some kind of mental disorder in their lives. About 6% will suffer symptoms severe enough to disrupt their normal daily activities. The study, published yesterday in the Archives of General Psychiatry, looked at four specific categories of mental illness, including mood disorders, anxiety disorders, substance abuse, and impulse control disorders. It says most mental illness begins early in life, sometimes as early as childhood, and if left untreated, can develop into severe and debilitating illness. We'll talk with the author of the study in just a moment. We also want to hear from you. If you're someone who suffers from a mental illness, did you seek treatment? If not, what prevented you? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. We'd also welcome calls from those of you who have questions about how the study was conducted or what its implications are. And joining us now is Ronald Kessler, a professor of healthcare policy at Harvard Medical School. He led this study, and he's with us from the studios of WBUR in Boston. Thanks very much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
How did the study define mental health?
Well, mental health was defined in terms of the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Psychiatric Disorders, and there are very specific criteria for exactly what qualifies as a depression and a panic disorder and so forth and so on.
Yet it does not include schizophrenia.
Well, this paper didn't include schizophrenia as one of the core disorders, but in fact, we assess schizophrenics, and the vast majority of schizophrenics meet criteria for one of the disorders we did count. So when we count people who have serious disorders, the vast majority of schizophrenics in America are included there.
Okay. The study found nearly half of all Americans will suffer some kind of mental illness. Are we talking about some severe mental illness?
No. You know, there have been several people who've commented on that particular finding, but I think it's important to put it into context. If I were to say to you that 99.9% of the population has had a physical illness at some time in their life, you wouldn't bat an eye, of course, because we all have splinters and common colds and so forth. And there are such things in the mental health domain as well. When somebody moves from one town to another and for a couple of weeks gets depressed because they miss all their friends and maybe can't focus on their work and so forth, that would meet minimally the criteria for a major depressive episode. But the vast majority of such things are self-limiting and mild and people get over them. If you count those things, half of all Americans have had some kind of clinically significant emotional experience at some time in their life.
Another fascinating element of this study, and perhaps it's fascinating to those of us who are not less familiar with this stuff than you are, but this mental illness is a disease of youth.
Yes, I think that is something that's not well known. If you about 6% of the U.S. population in a given year has a seriously impairing mental disorder, and that's about the same number as what you find for people who have a serious cardiovascular disease or serious diabetes or a cancer. And the big difference is that those other things start typically, the average person who has one of them has it start at the age of 50 or so. Of the people who will ever have a mental disorder in their life, a full 50% of them have the first episode start before the age of 15.
Hmm. And so, I was just going to interject that some people will quibble on your definition of diabetes is not a youth disease, but go ahead.
Well, there are people who have diabetes in youth, that's right. But when you look at the average age of onset of these disorders, most chronic physical disorders, of course, are disorders of older people. There are things like asthma, for example, that often start in childhood. But when you look at the health problems of people in the population in their teens, in their 20s, in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, among young people, mental disorders are clearly the number one most impairing chronic illnesses in the population.
And signs of this are often missed.
Yes, that's true. One of the most disturbing things of the study was that although we find that the vast majority of people with a serious mental illness eventually will get treatment, it takes them on average a decade between the age of onset and the age of first going and seeing a professional. And sadly, the earlier the onset, the longer the delay.
Why does it take so long for people to get treated?
Well, a lot of these problems are sort of figure ground things. You know, when a person is chronically low-level depressed their whole life, they don't think of it as an illness. They think of it as life. and it's the people who have the acute onsets that that see the difference. So you find these things that are called accretion disorders, which is that sort of everybody gets a little depressed, and then some people a little bit more and a little bit more and so forth. They're the kind of things that people delay getting into treatment for. When a person has a panic disorder, on the other hand, it's very common that they get into treatment the very same day they have their first panic attack. They go to the emergency room and think they're having a heart attack. But it's the early things tend to be social phobias, generalized anxiety disorder, just being a worry wart, depression, phobias of various sorts. People who are fearful, they fear animals, fear dogs, for example, is a very common early fear. School phobia, kids who are clinging to their mothers, and just instead of, as they get into adolescence, getting more and more confident, they get more and more withdrawn. Those are the kind of things you see that don't get into treatment very quickly.
Let's get some listeners in on the conversation. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're speaking with Ronald Kessler, professor of healthcare policy at Harvard Medical School. And let's talk with Todd. Todd's on the line with us from San Francisco.
Hi. Great show today.
Thank you.
I'm calling about, for me, I have ADHD. I'm also dyslexic, but I wasn't diagnosed until I was like 38. I'm 43 now.
Mm-hmm.
So I went through my whole life, through grade school, everything with the dyslexia and all the symptoms of it. And
the attention deficit disorder.
Attention deficit disorder, yeah, and hyperactive. But I wasn't a totally out of control person, so I think that's probably why I wasn't caught. But then when later in my life, I mean, I own my own property and was married and all that, and I wondered, why aren't I normal, you know? And so I finally went in, and they just said, wow, I can't believe you made it through your life this long of the things, the successes I had and all that. And so when they finally did, and then I got on medication, and that helped because I'd been misdiagnosed, too, as depressed. There was a nice article in New York Times magazine 2 years ago, Taste of My Own Medicine. They put me on antidepressants, but it did not work for me. It was a totally different experience in my life. And so I quit that, and then they noticed it was the Ritalin. I'm just hyper, and I'm an artist. But I noticed in nature how I could work with that, and I started working with kids to make sure that they could focus, with the same symptoms I had, and so that's what I do now.
Ooh, Todd, that's interesting. And Ronald Kessler, I hate to use Todd as a test case, but he called in. He illustrates a couple of points, not only diagnosed long after problems set in, but more than one problem.
Yes, that's right. It's very common for people to have more than one problem. Todd's a good example of something that happens quite often in very competent people with ADHD, and also people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s before ADHD was a widely diagnosed condition in school. Todd missed by about 10 years the time when the teachers had their antennas out for this as a problem. So he made it through school before that was the case. And because he's clearly somebody who's a successful person, smart people with ADHD, because they tend to be go-getters and active and so forth, they can overcome the inattentiveness problem by their hard work and intelligence. Typically what happens is when they finally get into treatment, they discover they can concentrate a whole heck of a lot better, and their native intelligence gets to get them to be more productive, considerably so, than they were in the past. You know, it used to be thought that ADHD was a condition that just burned itself out, to use a totally non-scientific word, in adolescence, and when you came
that,
became
that you
an adult,
outgrew it,
that you outgrew it, right? But we now know that about 50% of the people who have ADHD as kids still continue to have it as adults, and Todd's a case of that. There's a lot of people with ADHD as kids who don't get treated, who get into secondary problems because of the hyperactivity, and the conduct problems, and then they get kicked out of school and so forth and so on. But Todd's one of the ones who it sounds like he channeled his energies in the right direction and at some point discovered he was getting some blockages and got some help. He also illustrates another thing, though, that it often takes people trying and trying and trying a third time before they get a treatment that works for them, because mental disorders are very complicated. Very often, symptoms of one condition mask as symptoms of another, and you have to be perseverant to be able to get the treatment that works. But if those who persevere, in the vast majority of cases, they do get effective treatment.
And Todd, you may want to tune in tomorrow. We're going to be talking about adults with learning disabilities. So
I heard that, so I said I can't wait to listen to tomorrow.
Okay.
So.
All right. Thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
We are talking with Ronald Kessler. He's the director of a new study on mental health in America that shows troubling numbers of Americans with mental problems, and even perhaps more troubling numbers on those who seek help. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Richard. Richard's with us from Miami.
Yes, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. The first thing was I just had a question as far as how do they, the numbers, I heard you guys were saying about, like, they say a lot of it starts as children. Is mm-hmm. that coming, like, is that coming from, like doctors' diagnoses, or, like, what is that coming from? Like, where is that coming from?
Ronald Kessler?
Well, this particular study was one that went out and knocked on 10,000 doors around America. We didn't use doctors' diagnoses, and the reason is that we know their biases and the kinds of people who come to see doctors. We were actually mm-hmm. particularly interested in the people who don't come to see doctors, because we wanted to see what are the kind of barriers, psychological, financial, and so forth, that keep people who need help away. And in terms of this age thing that we've been talking about, we found I was going to say the word fascinating, but it's distressing is really a more accurate word. And I mentioned it a moment ago, that we know that people who start having these problems earliest in life tend to be the most persistent and the most severe cases. So early onset cases really need help in some ways more than later onset cases. But they tend to delay longer. And as a result of that, if we had gone only to treatment samples, we would have missed the fact that there are a lot of these people with chronic problems who just learn to live with it. So for example, people who have agoraphobia or painful social anxiety, they end up never leaving the house, or they get a job where they can work in the basement as a computer programmer and never have to deal with people, but they never get into treatment because they carve out a life for themselves that allows them to hide out from having to deal with those kind of problems they have and don't have the full life they could have. Now, when we ask them about age of onset, these were all people who were adults telling us retrospectively, reconstructing their lives, telling us, according to their recollection, how old they were when things first started.
Okay. And then what I also wanted to add was that 80% of the patients who come in to see me it's pretty much all ADD, every single person with a...
I take it from that you're a doctor, Richard.
Yes, with a child psychiatrist, actually.
Thank you.
Every single person who comes in, like, has a child that's hyper, and most children by nature are, you know, intrinsically going to be hyper, which is one thing that goes with it. And, like, I try to use, you know, all other means possible before medicating, because I feel like at this point in time, it's become a very big, like, you know, pill-pushing society where there's a lot of doctors in my field who will do the exact same thing, every parent who comes in with a hyper child will, you know, just hand them the drugs and think this is just a magic drug to make, you know, to make their children behave better or learn better in mm-hmm. school. And I don't think that it's a right drug for all people. So I was going to see what your thoughts were on that.
Yes, I think that's right. Now, as I said, this is a study that we did of adults, but there have been studies of kids that have shown quite clearly that there's a lot of overdiagnosis mm-hmm. of medication for ADHD in certain sectors of society. And as you suggested, in middle-class communities in particular,
yeah.
moms and dads want their kids to survive and succeed and so forth. And if there's any little hint of the first time they're inattentive, they say, boy, he's got a problem. Let me go get him that pill. So you're absolutely right being cautious about this.
We'll do that. Mm-hmm. We'll do that very quickly.
We got an email on this subject from Deborah in Irvine, California. A psychiatrist recently told me about my teenage son, that teens manifest almost every sign of every mental illness through the teenage years, and if they still have the same symptoms at 25 years old, only then do they get a diagnosis. How can you differentiate teen onset early symptoms from normal teenage behavior? So.
Well, you're right. I mean, my wife had said to me, we have four children, and she said, as far as she can tell, all children are crazy, and it's kind of difficult to sort them out. You know, they run around when they're little like wild Indians, and they have teenaged angst and depression and moodiness and stuff, and it's very, very difficult at a point in time to sort out these mild cases. The people that we're talking to, of course, it's very easy because they're looking backwards through time, and it's always easy in retrospect to see, well, back then I had this thing, mm-hmm. whether then they knew it is not. And that is a challenge for the future. We see in these epidemiologic data something that's easy for us as scientists to say to the clinicians, hey, you guys do something about it. It's a whole different matter to do it. And what we see is that at the age of 25, people come into treatment very often with a combination of being anxious and depressed, sometimes ADHD, very often having a substance problem, who they were teenage mothers who flunked out of high school and now are addicted to drugs and are on welfare, and at 25 they say, help me. This started, as far as I can tell, about at the age of 10 when I first started feeling withdrawn. Well, we can make the depression and the anxiety go away, and we can give medications for the ADHD and do drug rehab. It's pretty difficult to make the two children evaporate, or to get them to go back and get a high school education, or recover that 10 years of life they haven't had. So from our perspective, it seems that the obvious thing to do is to figure out how we could discriminate which of those 15-year-old or 12-year-olds are the ones that are going to grow into that 25-year-old with a real mess versus the ones who are going to grow out of it. And if we could figure out how to do that, to come up with some early intervention that would prevent that pileup of problems from happening before they walk into the door at the age of 25. The trick, of course, as your email mm-hmm. person said, is it's very tough to sort those things out when you're out there in the real world at the age of 12, where everybody looks a little bit odd.
Ronald Kessler, thanks very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Ronald Kessler, professor of healthcare policy at Harvard Medical School, and he joined us today from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan.